We didn't get all the way through chapter 20 last week. In fact, we didn't even get all the way through the part that I said we were going to get all the way through. And that's okay. We're here to study because we want to know Jesus, and we want to know his ways, and we want to hear what he has to say and walk in those ways. And so we'll just take as long as we need. When I was trying to figure out what to do, whether to start 21 and just whiz over the last part of this, I felt very strongly, strong enough that I spent 6 or 7 hours studying on Friday. I felt like the Lord said he had things that we needed to look at in the passage that we ended with last week, about the difference between the upside down kingdom, the kingdom we belong to now, where the king and all those who are like him are serving rather than ruling over others. And he told me that we had some things to study, and as I began looking at it, I myself was greatly strengthened. And we're going to kind of, and we'll finish chapter 20, and next week we'll look at what I personally think is one of the most astonishing fulfillments of prophecy. Jesus fulfilled over 300 Old Testament prophecies specifically. I mean, things that could not be coincidences. And one of them is the event that we look at next week. Way back in Daniel chapter 9, God spoke to Daniel about stuff Daniel didn't even know what it was about. God had to explain the parts that were explainable to his Jewish/Babylonian brain. But in that prophecy, in chapter 9 of Daniel, it said, from the time that the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem goes forth until the time that Messiah comes to Jerusalem will be 483 Babylonian years. 173,880 days later, to the day, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a colt of a donkey to the cheers and shouts of people. To the day. Impossible to manipulate. So we'll look at that next week. That's an hors d'oeuvre. I'm sorry, I need my... Today we'll start reading at verse 25 of chapter 20. We'll finish what Jesus says. We'll look at it in great detail. What he says about the way he looks at things, about greatness in God's eyes. And as we looked at it briefly last week, you realize that, you know, if you live your life the way Jesus said was great, if you live your life like him, you're gonna be very unappreciated at the very best by most people, and you will be despised by others at worst. So we'll look at what he has to say, and then we'll look at a demonstration of what it means to be interruptible. Gail Irwin points out in his book, The Jesus Style, that most of Jesus' most profound teaching and ministry happened during interruptions, from our point of view. He's on his way somewhere, he's on his way to do something, but because of the way that his heart was, those interruptions turned into some of our very favorite things that he did, and that's a good model, I think. So verse 25, what we have just seen is two of the disciples putting their mom up to asking Jesus if they could have the two positions of prominence as Jesus was about to come into his kingdom, which they were absolutely positive was any day now. And he said, you don't really know what you're asking. And as they often did, they had been arguing about which of one of them was the greatest. And when the ten who didn't say out loud what they all were thinking, when they heard what James and John had done, they were indignant, verse 24 says. So Jesus called them all together. I want you to note something. We sang a song today from Matthew 23:11. That's three chapters down the road. We are about to embark on the last week of Jesus' life. If you knew that you were going to die in a week, and you knew how it was going to happen, you knew the state of mind of the people that you loved, there would be a certain urgency in what you said. In fact, probably you would only say the things that you thought were most important. I'd like you to note as we go through, this will take us, I don't know, maybe a month or two to get through the next week of Jesus' life, but I'd like for you to note how many times he talked about this very thing. And the reason is obvious. They didn't get it. They heard what he said, they saw the way he lived, and it didn't penetrate. So it's worth looking at again for us. He called them all together, verse 25. I'm getting a little bit of feedback up here. It could be the monitor. He called them together, and he didn't tell them about feedback. That's strike that from the record. Okay. Here's what he said. You are familiar, or you know, how the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them and how their high officials literally tyrannized them, the Amplified Bible says. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first, that the Greek word means chief, which is kind of interesting. So I'm going to read it that way. Whoever wants to be chief must be your slave. Well, the thing is, they all wanted to be chief. James and John were just the ones bold enough to say it out loud, but they were constantly arguing about it. So he says, okay, if that's what you want, the one that wants to be chief must be your slave. Circle the next two words, just as. That's what we're going to talk about today. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Last week, if you were here, I had you underline the word ransom. It's an important one of those make you smile words. And I'll read the next blurb in the next event, and we'll talk about it in a minute. But let's look at, we're calling the study today, Just Like Jesus. The specific word that's used in verse 28, I had you circle just as. It's a very precise word. It means exactly like Jesus. So on that side of the cross, Jesus looked at these guys who have been with him for 3 years. They've camped out. They've walked with him. They've seen him under the almost the most pressure of his life, although the events in the next week were certainly going to be the worst pressure. They've watched him. They've observed him. They've seen the way that he treated people, and it always blew their minds. He loved people they thought God hated. He did not buy the religious line of the religious leaders. He always dealt with reality and not manipulation and not phoniness. And so their brains were scrambled watching him. It was obvious that he had God's power. It was obvious that he was not a normal human. So when he says, the way I want you to act, if you want to be great in God's kingdom, if you don't care, if you want to be great in the world's kingdom, disregard everything Jesus says, because it won't work in the world kingdom. If you want to impress pagans, they are not going to be impressed with living the way Jesus did now any more than they were then. Perhaps people who are humble and have a tender heart, it will open their hearts, but the people who are jockeying for positions in the world system are not going to respect you if you live like Jesus. They just won't, never have, historically. So you choose which kingdom you want to be great in. The sad thing is you can't even look at the church and follow that example, because the church, by and large, has got the same political junk and posturing that you see in the world. So the only safe place to look is to look at Jesus. they had the advantage of watching him day by day by day. We have the historical advantage because we've got the historical accounts. We have another advantage that they at this particular time did not have. After the cross, on this side of it, we have the supreme example of how much God loves us, what lengths he is willing to go to bring us close. We have that example. We have the example of obedience unto death because of love. So we have example they did not yet have. We have another advantage, as we've been studying in the book of Acts on Wednesday. We have a different relationship to the Spirit of God now than they did. That's why Jesus in John 15 told them, you know, I am going away. I know that's going to freak you out, but I want you to know it's going to actually be better for you, because instead of having one body, one person, you will have the very Spirit of God living in you. You open your hearts to that and you'll have me living in each one of you. So what is not natural to us and is natural to him, in order for it to be natural to us, we require basically two things. One is hanging out with Jesus all the time and being filled with his Holy Spirit so that our natural human reactions are changed. I loved your testimony last week, Wayne, about just seeing in your own life that you're not the same person you used to be. Yeah, the potential is always there because we still have this stinking flesh we hang out in. But when you can look and realize God has worked in my life to such an extent that my knee-jerk reaction is not exactly the same as it used to be. In fact, sometimes it's astonishingly opposite of what it used to be. That's a wonderful thing. I always like to point out when we look at James and John, who we just saw in an embarrassing light last week, the sons of thunder. These are the guys that wanted to smoke the Samaritans. Remember, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to die for the sins of the world. These guys hated Samaritans and you know, feeling this raw sense of power. Yeah, we're hanging out with the king. Can we just toast the entire nation of Samaria? You think, how can you even think that way? You know what? I know church people that would like to toast all of the homosexuals. I even know some church people that would like to toast all of the Democrats. God couldn't love those people. So how far off the same page with God is it possible for church people to get? Jesus looked at them and he said, when you talk like that, you do not know what spirit you're of. And that's the pathetic thing. It wasn't that they thought that way. That was pathetic. What was most pathetic was they thought he thought that way. I think that's the thing that breaks my heart the most when I look at the state of the church, is I just think we don't even know what spirit we're of. We don't know how opposite we look at the world from the way that Jesus does. To be fair, John of James and John. James was killed. He was the first martyr put to death. John outlived all of the other guys. The last 50 years of John's life, maybe 60 years, the greater bulk of John's life, you know what his nickname was? The Apostle of Love. I always feel like I should say that in Barry White's voice. The Apostle of Love. Can you think of two more completely opposite reputations they have than the Son of Thunder, the gunslinger for Jesus, the guy that wants to kill an entire nation, to the Apostle of Love? What changed him? Same two things that change us. One, he hung out with Jesus. And after Pentecost, he was filled with Jesus. Filled, empowered, recalibrated by the same Spirit of God that was so obvious in Jesus. That's available to you, that's available to me. I wrote some things down because I know it's not a popular message. You can talk about being a servant, the very thing that Jesus said, sounds wrong to people. And to our culture, it is wrong. There's just not going to be a way you're going to be able to meet people halfway. People who believe that the way to succeed and to achieve is to believe in yourself first. And God's kingdom, which says, no, by the way, I'm your designer, I made you, I know that's not going to work, it's not going to fill you up the way you think it is, the way that you can be great in my kingdom, he said, is to be just like me. It is the best way to live. It's the same Jesus that said in the Sermon on the Mount, it's more blessed to give than to receive. Does anybody believe that? Yeah, right. Yeah, sure it is. You know what? The only people that believe that are people that do that. And you do that, you realize he was not exaggerating. It's really true. So it pays to listen to our Creator. Not so with you, verse 26. Boy, if there were ever disobeyed words of Jesus, those historically in the church have been the most disobeyed. Instead, he says, I love that he tells us what to do, and then he uses himself as the example. Once again, put yourself in their place. I would have panicked had I heard him say these words. I panic now when I hear him say these words, except now I know something they didn't know. He's living in me. Biblical Christianity is not a whole bunch of people trying to be like Jesus. Biblical Christianity is the living, breathing Jesus who didn't stay dead, living, and a bunch of people who invited him in. And he lives his life in us. And there's a vast difference between those two things. You won't be able to live like Jesus by yourself. He knows that. That's why he told us, these very same guys in John 15, he said, you cut off from me, from life coming directly from me, you can't produce anything. Any more than a branch cut off from the vine can produce fruit. But he said, abiding in me, connected to me, vitally linked to me, my life flowing into you, you're going to bear a lot of fruit. In fact, you're going to do the same kind of things that I did. So that's my hope. My hope is not to set the bar higher and grunt harder and try to be like Jesus. My hope is to look at where I'm not like Jesus and say, come in, take over. Let all that is not of you be washed away. Fill my life. Overflow every part of me. Then why do we need to look at these instructions? I do know this. I don't ask to be fixed unless I know I'm broken. I've told you about the flypaper lady. By the way, I saw her at my dad's funeral, of all places. I hadn't seen this woman in 33 years. And it just so last time I saw her, I was saying at her wedding at Jack Hayford's church down in Los Angeles. And here I'm doing my dad's funeral in California a couple of months ago, and she walks up. She has not changed. She looks exactly the same, except she's 60 years old, and I'm 60 years old. And I confess to her that hard lesson that God had taught me. And she confessed to me the hard lesson that God had taught her, and we were really glad that we knew each other. I was so irritated at her at the time, those of you that don't know the story. I just got a couple emails today from new people that are in other parts of the country that are picking up our website, so I'll say for their benefit also. I thought I was a person who never lost my temper, but that was only because I only hung out with people that agreed with me. And of course, if you're around people that constantly agree with you, of course you're the most patient person in the whole world, right? Because they're not actually other people. They're you in other bodies. So what did God do? He hooked me up with a woman. She was a secretary. She was a good secretary. But she just about didn't agree with anything. She did everything exactly, pretty much, not the opposite, but a different way. And you know what? The fruit of her life was, I started losing my temper. And I remember one night, I was saying, God, what is wrong with this woman? I was a perfectly patient man until she came along. And the angels are just going, oh, man. Just fire him. Just fire him. Do the world a favor. See, the problem wasn't her. But I didn't know the problem was me until God brought somebody along that brought that to the surface. So don't underestimate the fact that God plants you in a church filled with people that are not like you. He did for me. And that shows us that we need Jesus. Every time my flesh is caught hanging out, every time my flesh is caught for its self-centered what it is, that's an opportunity for me to say, Jesus, I am not like you. And I want to be. And a big smile breaks out across his face. And he says, I was hoping you'd say that. And he begins to work. So he gives them, in absolutely direct contrast to their whole mindset, he says, well, if you want to be great, and of course, obviously, you do want to be great in my kingdom, well, here's the way greatness looks. Here's what it looks like in my kingdom. Learn to be the servant of everybody. You want to be chief? Learn to be the slave of everybody. Last week I gave you a list of a couple of things that sort of characterized that servant posture, that servant mindset. And it is a posture. It's not what you do, it's the way you think that says whether you're a servant. Because you know how we are. God gives us one job for 5 years, we start thinking that's our specialty. But a servant really has no specialty. A servant will do whatever his master asks him to do. And we talked about that a little bit last week and how humbling it was for me to find out that I thought I was very devoted until I felt used and unappreciated. And then I realized I'm not as devoted because this bugs me. So here are four things I wrote down. I'll give them to you again because this is not natural to us. We do leak. Humility is the first attitude or posture of a servant. Number two is willingness to be unrecognized. Chuck tells a story of in his first church, when the very first Sunday he took over in this church, there was a beautiful big spray of flowers in front of the pulpit. In fact, it was such a big, beautiful spray of flowers that he couldn't see the people. So he moved them off to the side. There was a note on the pulpit that said, these flowers were donated by Sister So-and-so. And when he set his Bible down on the pulpit, he didn't see it. So he didn't say anything. So the next Sunday, the flowers were back in their place. There was a sign, several signs, saying, these flowers, capital letters, were donated, blah, 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 blah. Well, he had to move the flowers out of the way the second time because he couldn't see anybody in the first row. And once again, he didn't say anything. The next Sunday, the same thing happened. And there was a note that said, if you do not recognize the person who gave these flowers, there will be no flowers next Sunday. And he said, sure enough, there weren't. Church people are famous for that. I think the biggest tip-off there is to whether somebody has the true heart of a servant like Jesus is by, will they do what they do, even if nobody thanks them? Will they do what they do without being recognized, without a title? And I have to tell you, we have a large number of people in this church who have that kind of heart, and they are the treasures of my life. And if I tell you who they are, then it'll ruin everything. Third thing about the posture of a servant is attentiveness to need. We have a number of people with that kind of a heart as well. They're just, their whole mindset when they walk in is, does anybody need anything? Now, don't you want to live in a world like that? What if you lived in a world where everybody thought that way? It would be paradise, wouldn't it? The problem is that we're part of that world. I see this in marriages all the time. You describe, you know, a husband that thinks this way, and the wife says, "Wow, I want that kind of marriage." But you understand that you're half of the marriage, don't you? The way to have that kind of marriage is for the husband to be that way and for the wife to be that way. Not for each one to sit there and expect the other person to do their part. Oh, I was going to say way worse stuff than that this morning. So, and the other thing we see in this passage today that we're going to look at the end of our time is interruptibility, I call it. To be so available that whatever it is that you're doing can be interrupted. And of course, we are constantly hearing wonderful stories about people experiencing that in their lives. So, I have a couple of rabbit trails I want to go down, but let's look at this phrase, "just as," verse 28, "exactly like the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve." The Son of Man, just say this for you Bible students, the Son of Man was Jesus' favorite title that was designated for Messiah. It comes from the book of Daniel. And of all of the ones, I mean, he took that title in a number of ways, but it was the one that he liked to use the most. So he's speaking of himself. "Just exactly like I did not come to be served." The Amplified Bible says, "did not come to be waited on." Oh, the stories I could tell. Back in the days when I was well-known, a well-known singer, and I traveled all over the place, and I went to huge, humongous, big mega churches and did concerts and met pastors who had unlisted phone numbers, and everyone had to call them doctor. Met people whose whole posture towards the people God sent them to serve was, "I'm important and you're not, and you should cater to my every whim." Just the opposite posture. It's distasteful. The only people that seem to like it are the people who want to have their own little kingdom and model themselves after that so that they can learn to manipulate people and get that themselves. You sure don't like that if you're under that. And that's kind of the mindset that these guys were in when Jesus said these words. They're trying to be important. And he said, "Watch me. Do I act anything like that? Look at how I'm acting and be just like that." Well, the first thing, like I said, that happens is you realize very sheepishly that I'm nothing like him. The fact that I'm thinking about being great proves I'm nothing like him. So, some great rabbit trails to look at. I wanted you to know the Greek word for the word ransom. I told you last week, and then I forgot to give you the word, and it's a good thing I did because I looked it up this morning and I realized I was wrong. I had the wrong word in my notes. So God protected me from looking foolish in front of Fred, our resident Greek expert. Lutron is the Greek word, L-U-T-R-O-N. I told you last week that it's a word that might surprise you. It's translated redeem, or derivatives of the word are translated redeem, or in this case, ransom. Here's what it means. It is the word for the price which is paid to buy a slave in order to set him free. What happens if you leave your non-Christian life to join a religious system as opposed to giving your life to Jesus? What happens is you trade one set of chains for a new set of chains, and the new set of chains have crosses on them. They're religious chains, but they're still chains. They're still bondage. You know, come to our church and, you know, Jesus will set you free from the chains that bind you, and here we'll give you a whole new set of chains. But the Bible says that the one that the Son of God sets free is really free. Really free. Not just squint your eyes and pretend you're free, but really free. There is a Greek word, I didn't write it down, but there is a Greek word for buying a slave in order to make him your slave. Just the exchange of property. Isn't it amazing that God, though he has the right to view us that way, Jesus paid with his own life to take we who were slaves, and his life was the price that he paid, not to make us his slaves, but to set us free. If you were transferred into a really religious system which was very legalistic or formal and not real, those are exciting words. The first time I saw this, I realized, the freer that I felt in the church I grew up in, the freer that I felt, the more guilty I felt. In fact, when I started going to a church where I would walk away feeling better than I did when I came, I felt guilty. I did it wrong. I feel really good on my way home. Whereas in the other system, please silence all cell phones, especially pastoral ones. Jesus paid with his life to buy us who were slaves in order to set us free. Just let your brain roll that around for a while. In Galatians, Paul said it's for freedom that he set us free. Duh! But you'd be surprised how many people, in order to try to please God, live very unfree lives. So he says, watch me, watch the way that I'm going to live my life from this point on. I'm going to give it freely, lay it down. Watch and notice the way I've been living, and right in front of your eyes, that's the way that you should be. Did not come to be waited on, but to serve and to give his life. There's a really good cross-reference verse to put in here next to verse 28, that last statement, and it's 1 John 3:16. Not John 3:16, the one that you see in the end zone in football games and in basketball games behind the backboard. 1 John 3:16, it's the first epistle that John wrote. It says this: this is how we know what love is, that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And then the next verse says, and so we should lay our lives down for each other as well, as a response to that. The phrase "laid down his life" doesn't speak only of his death on the cross. That was the end of him laying down his earthly life. But it speaks of the entire way he lived his life. That's how we know what love is. Look at the way Jesus lived his life. It's the same thing that he's saying here. Here's my first rabbit trail. In our just like Jesus application of this, I've pondered this, and I actually talked with a couple of people who asked me questions. In fact, it reminded me of something that in Gail Irwin's revised book, The Jesus Style, after years of it being out, and he was able to answer some questions that people had asked. One of them concerned, because he lays out a whole book of how what being a servant of other people looks like in Jesus' name. And somebody asked the question and says, well, how do you deal with manipulators? Because the church is filled with manipulators. People that will manipulate you. The minute they see that you have the posture that you're going to serve them, there are some kinds of personalities that will use that against you. I've seen that with also with husbands and wives. And humans are twisted in our selfishness sometimes. So here's an interesting thing. I wanted to give you this scripture. Jesus said, I only do the things that my Father tells me to do. And that, I didn't write down what part of John that's in, but it's, I believe that it's in 16, John chapter 16.